What do you have that weighs about 3 pounds, is more than half fat, and contains about 100 billion neurons? Your brain, of course. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, my guests for the entire hour are three prominent neuroscientists who are visiting Iowa. Dr. John Brugge of the University of Wisconsin, Dr. George Pollack of the University of Texas, and Dr. Brett Schofield of Northeastern Ohio University. We'll find out about their research, get their take on some of the latest brain news, and find out how they answer some of the most puzzling mysteries about this gray organ between our ears. That's all coming up after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we want to devote this entire hour to an organ in our bodies that has amazed and baffled people throughout the ages. It weighs about 3 pounds. It's more than half made of fat and contains about 100 billion neurons. Of course, I'm talking about the human brain. Some scientists and doctors have devoted their entire lives to learning how the brain works, and we have the good fortune today of having three of them in the studio for the entire hour. They are three prominent neuroscientists who are visiting Iowa to participate in Neuroscience Day at Iowa State University. Let me introduce them. Dr. John Brugge is with us, a professor of neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Dr. Brugge, welcome.
Well, thank you, Ben.
And Dr. George Pollack, also in our Ames studio, professor of neurobiology at the University of Texas. Welcome to you, George.
Thank you.
And Dr. Brett Schofield, he is a professor at the Northeast Ohio Medical University in the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology. Dr. Schofield, welcome to you.
Thank you, Ben.
And once again, all three have been invited to Ames to Iowa State University to speak as part of Neuroscience Day, which is Friday, September 20th. Well, gentlemen, we want to touch on as many aspects of the brain this hour as possible, how it works, how it develops, what controls it, how it affects sleep, dreams, memory, our perceptions, and possibly some of our misperceptions. Toward the end of the hour, I want to talk about how the brain is understood in popular culture and what we know to be true about the brain, perhaps not true from popular culture. All those things are fair game. But first of all, I wanted to start off by having you acquaint us with your specific area of study in neuroscience. And Dr. Pollack, can I ask you first of all to start us off by telling us a little bit about your specialty? You busy yourself, you've concerned yourself with the processing of sound in our auditory systems. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's correct. So what I do is my research is concerned with basically two of the major features of what we do with our ears. That is, what happens when sound gets in the brain? And in particular, how do the neural circuits process the information that basically allows you to determine where the sound came from and what it is? Mm-hmm. And the basic techniques that I use are to record from individual neurons. That is, I talk to neurons. I enter into a dialogue with them.
Okay, let's be clear. That's a basic idea we need to understand. A neuron is a nerve cell in our brain, and it's what our brain is made of, right?
That's correct. And it has lots of interconnections. So the information, for example, that comes in from your cochlea, the inner ear, goes into the brain, and it makes connections with other neurons through places called synapses. And thus, one neuron basically talks to another neuron, except each neuron is spoken to by many others, and it integrates the information and then basically makes an executive decision. And what I mean by that, it produces an output. The output is an electrical signal called an action potential. And what I do is I talk to neurons, very much like Dr. Brugge does also, and we put electrodes into the brain, very, very, very fine electrodes, and we talk to an individual neuron. And the way we talk to it is we present sound to it. So we present different frequencies, and we present it to one ear and then the other ear. And the neuron then talks back to us. And the way it speaks is with its production of these electrical signals called action potentials, which is the output of the neuron. So we get to know the neuron. We say, Mr. Neuron, how are you? Which frequency do you like? And we present all these frequencies, and it says, ah, I like this frequency. By like meaning that's what it responds to. And then you ask, well, what ear do you like? Or really, do you get inputs from? So you present it to one ear, you present it to the other ear, and then you present the sounds together and ask, well, how do you respond when you actually receive two signals at the same time? And then you can ask lots of other questions, such as, well, exactly what kind of signal do you like? And then after you determine that, you can begin to ask other questions, like how does the circuitry that plays upon you, that speaks to you, how does it determine the particular signal that you respond to maximally or even exclusively? Mm-hmm. That's basically what I do.
Okay, so this is interesting. So you talked about the two main components here, the quality, the recognizing the sound, the processing of the sound, and then finding out where that sound comes from.
That's right.
So how do we determine where things come from?
Ah, that's a very good question, right? And it's been known for a long time about the cues that you use, that is the acoustic cues. So basically what happens is that the brain has to make a computation of where the sound is coming from. It's not inherent in the cochlea because the cochlea really records and maps frequency. So the way you do this is you use the cues of the two ears. And the two major cues that are used are the differences in the arrival time of the two ears, which are used for localizing low-frequency sounds. And the other cue that you use for localizing high-frequency sounds is the difference in the intensity of the two ears. So if a sound comes from directly ahead, it will be equally loud in two ears. And if it comes from the side, it will be louder in one ear than the other ear. So the question becomes, well, how does the nervous system then make that computation? How does it process the coded intensities once it gets into the brain? How does it handle that? And how is that then handled in subsequently higher regions of the brain?
Mm. And I understand that you have investigated something very interesting, the hearing of bats, and that you like bat love songs. I didn't know there was such a thing, but there are.
Absolutely. Well, let me explain to you, first of all, bats, of course, are best known for their ability to use sound to navigate in the environment in a process called echolocation. And I really don't understand echolocation. I don't understand how the nervous system really handles it. We can come back to that if you wish to a little later on. Rather, what I do is I use them as model systems. They're mammals, and they have the same circuitry and features that other mammals have in their auditory systems. But it's big. Everything is huge, devoted to sound in their auditory systems.
What do you mean by big or huge?
Let me explain that. Okay, so they rely on sound to an inordinate degree for their survival. They rely on sound for echolocation, for communication, for a whole variety of things. And as a consequence, the portions of the brain that are devoted to the processing of sound are relatively enormous compared to the other parts of the brain because they rely to such a large extent on sound for their survival. So these areas are easy to get to. They offer experimental advantages. So what I do is I try to exploit those advantages to study how the mammalian auditory system processes information. So it turns out that these are animals live in caves, and they live in huge colonies. For example, the bats that I study in Texas exist in colonies on the order of millions. Well, it turns out there was a lady in Austin who adopted these bats. She took these bats when they were injured, and she became basically the Jane Goodall of bats. She created, built a barn in her backyard. She raised them. She fed them every day. She knew them. And she came to us, and she said, you know, these bats are constantly engaged in vocal communication, and she knew the context in which they're engaged. So we got some graduate students and postdocs with our equipment and went down there and recorded these vocal communications and the context in which they're emitted. And it turns out it's incredibly rich. They have to talk to each other. They have a community. So females talk to females. Males talk to other males. Males talk to females.
Could we say that their language, their communication, is as complex as ours?
No. Nothing's as complex as ours. But I would say next to us, it's one of the richest and most sophisticated in the animal kingdom.
Still a lot to learn, it sounds like.
There's an enormous amount to learn. And you mentioned the love songs. Well, yeah, they do. They like birds, sing to each other. And song has a very definite meaning. It's the call that's emitted by a male during the breeding season in order to attract females and to defend its territory. And that's exactly what bats use their songs for. And they're very elaborate. And one of the questions that we asked is, well, how does the brain process this? And how does it know one of the calls or one of the songs and distinguish it from any other song? And it's a fundamental question in the auditory system. How do we hear certain kinds of sounds that have certain meanings, and how does the brain then distinguish that sound from all other sounds?
George Pollack is one of my guests today on River to River. He's a neurobiologist visiting Iowa State University this week for Neuroscience Day. He's from the University of Texas. We have two other prominent neuroscientists with us, Dr. John Brugge and Dr. Brett Schofield. John Brugge, let me turn to you. You're an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and you are giving a talk, Unlocking Secrets of the Human Brain, on Neuroscience Day, the last neuroscience's last frontier. You have a collaboration actually going on with the University of Iowa, a neurosurgery team at the University of Iowa hospitals, to examine brain function in human subjects with implanted electrodes in various regions of the brain. Describe the nature of that work.
Sure, Ben. Well, let me give a little bit of a background to how I got there, because I think my research and George Pollack's ran pretty much a parallel track in animal-based experiments on how information about our acoustic world is encoded and transmitted through the ascending auditory pathways. And I focused much of my attention in recent years on the cerebral cortex, that is, that layer of cells that covers the rest of the brain. That's what we see when we have a picture of a brain of any animal, including a human. And we do it in the belief that we have fundamental processes going on that are occurring in all critters, from bats to rats to cats to monkeys and to humans. And there's where the divide may come. And over my research career, I had studied several species of monkeys and their auditory cortex, and put that aside for a while. This was some years ago, and went on to some other critters. And then I reached a point of transition in my research career, and I thought, I don't like the term retirement, but that kind of is what it turns out to be. It's not a word I like, but most academics don't like it. And I, by quite accident, met at a meeting of the Society for Neuroscience about 15 years ago, a young neurosurgeon. And this young neurosurgeon had a scientific poster in which he showed an electrode implanted in a human brain that was capable of recording electrical activity from the very cortex that I had been pursuing for much of my research career. And I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. He was from the University of Iowa, and he had just come. He had been there a couple of years, and he was setting up a laboratory. And we got to chatting, and he says, well, why don't you come over to Iowa City from Madison? It's only a couple hours, and see what we're doing. And I thought, well, sure, I have nothing else to do now. I'm kind of making a transition. So I went over to see him. His name is Matt Howard. I had some experiences working with surgeons in the past. And for whatever reason, number of reasons. These never panned out. And I thought, well, maybe this is another one of those things. But Howard had a passion for research, absolute passion, still does. So one thing led to another, and a new career opened for me. And I looked at this situation where he was implanting in neurosurgical patients, mainly epilepsy patients, a very select group of patients who came in for their seizure disorders for diagnosis and treatment. These are people who no longer respond to medication. Their lives are terribly disrupted. And so the possible way of dealing with this and giving them some help is to remove that small piece of the cortex that is the source of the seizure. And surgeons do this all the time. A subset of those people, in order to do that, you really have to know where that source is. And through examining the patients and finding their symptoms and doing EEGs on the scalp, most people will reveal where that seizure focus is and they can go directly to surgery. But a small subset do not. And in order to find it, the electrodes have to be implanted not on the scalp but in the brain. Mm. So I thought, going back to my experience with monkeys in the past, I thought, well, this is great. we can study just another great big monkey, and I don't have to do any of the work. The surgeons will do the work. I'll just show up. And after a while, and I don't know what took me so long, I said, this is really a dumb idea. Dumb in the sense that humans are not just big monkeys, and monkeys are not just little people. In fact, here's a great opportunity to study things which are probably uniquely human. Mm. And so we got into a program of research which has expanded into a rather major research lab now at the University of Iowa in the Department of Neurosurgery. It's a consortium of about seven institutions, researchers from about seven institutions around the world. And we're dealing with the question of how the human cerebral cortex processes speech sounds.
Fascinating.
And speech, of course, can be expressed in a number of ways. It can be expressed by speaking. We have a conversation going here. A lot of dynamic activity is going on. A lot of dynamics is going on here in the process of speaking. So that's sort of basically where we're at.
So you've started a second career, and you thought of retirement as kind of a dirty word, so you don't have to talk about that anymore because you found this new passion in your collaboration with the University of Iowa. John Brugge is with us, one of the neuroscientists on our program today. We have about 5 minutes before we have to take a short break, and I want to definitely get, before we take the break, to the other neuroscientist in our room, in our studio in Ames. Brett Schofield is with us of the Northeast Ohio Medical University, a professor of anatomy and neurobiology. Now, Brett, I understand you also work with our hearing, how we hear. Your work focuses on how we hear. How specifically?
Well, I take a somewhat different approach from what we've heard so far. I'm interested in the same functions that the auditory system accomplishes, but I've been approaching it with techniques to help identify the specific brain circuits that are involved. And so I take my cues from the results of studies like we've been hearing about and try to understand which brain circuits might underlie those functions and how they might accomplish those functions.
Why is that important to understand?
There's a level at which we understand how individual neurons respond, and there's an increasing understanding of how groups of neurons respond. And I think that will provide us with information of how the brain does its job. Mm-hmm. But to understand the specific mechanisms, when Dr. Pollack described how a neuron integrates information from multiple sets of inputs. In many cases in the brain, in many areas of the brain, we don't know necessarily what those inputs are, which sets of inputs converge on an individual neuron. Mm-hmm. And that's methodologically one of the issues that I'm going after.
Mm-hmm. You wonder, a common phenomenon that happens that I think you sort out or can explain to us at least is something called the cocktail party effect. We've all been in the situation. You've got plenty of people in a room, voices going, other noises going, and yet the person next to you talking in a average volume, you're able to focus in on that. Even though all these inputs are coming in through your ear, how is your brain able to do that?
That's a wonderful question, and it's a question of great interest to many people, both from just a fundamental understanding of how the brain works and also because difficulty in this situation is something that occurs in many situations, including for most people with natural aging. It just becomes difficult to understand things in a noisy environment. And this is actually one of the sides of my research that we've been interested in looking at circuitry. So some of the things we've talked about earlier in the program talk about how sound comes into the ear and then is processed through the auditory system, through a whole variety of brain areas until it reaches cerebral cortex, which is the area we usually think of for perception. And much of my work over the past 10 years has been devoted toward looking at circuits that originate from these higher levels and that could serve to alter the way sound is processed at the earlier stages of the auditory pathway.
So as you say, this is sometimes connected with aging, that people have problems separating these signals. Your research could have a direct application to helping people with these problems.
That would be the hope, yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is very interesting. Brett Schofield, George Pollack, and John Brugge are with us, three prominent neuroscientists who are visiting Iowa to participate in Neuroscience Day at Iowa State University. That's on Friday, coming up, the 20th. We've got to take a short break, but before we do, I want to take a quick poll. I've never had three neuroscientists in the room at the same time, so this is a very exciting moment. I hear a lot of "I don't know." We don't know. We want to find out from all three of you. Before we take a short break, tell me, if we had a pie chart, and that pie chart represents everything, all understanding of the human brain, how much of that pie chart do we know right now? Something tells me it's less than half. Who wants to venture a guess? Can we have a consensus quickly before we go to a break? John Brugge?
Well, I think it's a very slender slice of that pie. Thin slice of that pie.
5-10%?
Yeah, we know some of the inputs. We know some of the outputs. It's that stuff that's in the middle that's the big mystery.
Okay, we'll come back and talk more with our neuroscientists in just a moment. It's a brainy day here on River to River, and we want to talk with our guests more. Also, when we come back, we'll talk about popular perceptions of the brain communicated through pop culture. I want to bounce a few perhaps movies off you that have to do with neuroscience to see if they resonate or not. We'll be back with more. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we have the good fortune of having in one room three prominent neuroscientists who are visiting Iowa to participate in Neuroscience Day at Iowa State University. Brett Schofield is with us. He's from Northeast Ohio Medical University. George Pollack is from the University of Texas, and John Brugge from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. You heard him describing some collaboration with the University of Iowa as well. And An hour is a long time, but far too short to explore all the fascinating things happening in neuroscience. Let's talk about a few more before the hour ends. I wanted to get your understanding of the most significant ways, as neuroscientists, the ways in which our understanding of the human brain has changed in recent years, and perhaps going outside of your specific field of neurobiology, of neuroscience, to look back maybe a generation or two to see what leaps we have made in understanding this roughly 3-pound organ between our ears. Who wants to go in first? Brett?
Okay. One of the prominent examples that comes to my mind is our understanding and our approach to treating Parkinson's disease. It's a very common disease, one I think many people are familiar with.
And what happens in Parkinson's disease very quickly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a motor disorder in which people lose the ability to control movement under normal conditions. And it's a result of a very specific set of nerve cells degenerating in the brain. And we don't understand why they degenerate. Mm-hmm. But the remarkable progress has been the discovery that it is these specific neurons. These neurons use a specific neurotransmitter for communicating with one another, and that's dopamine. And pharmacologic replacement of that dopamine leads to remarkable advances and not complete recovery, but remarkable improvements in the person's ability to make movements. And it's got limitations as the disease progresses, but over the years, as we've gotten a better understanding of the circuits involved and the different neurotransmitters that different cells use, that has led to advances in the pharmacologic treatment, so that while the disease still progresses, we're able to get better and better control to improve the patient's lives with that.
Mm-hmm. George Pollack, what would you point to as a leap forward in neuroscience in the last generation?
There's been a number of them, but the one that strikes me and really absolutely captivates me is the ability to record from a small number of neurons in the motor cortex. The motor cortex is the part of your cortex that sends projections or axons all the way down to the spinal cord and is largely responsible for your voluntary movement. And years ago, people started to conduct experiments in monkeys where they basically figured out how individual neurons might encode, that is, respond before the monkey makes a movement, and as a population, how they might work to direct the monkey's movement. And people have picked up on that, and they technically have now developed methods to take just small little chips with electrodes, that is, just little pieces of wire. They're specially made. It's not just any wire. And insert it into the motor cortex of humans and take a human being who is quadriplegic, mm-hmm, and be able to basically talk to those neurons, that is, to record the activity from a small number, put that activity into a computer, train the computer to interpret that activity, and allow that computer then to make movements of a prosthetic device that mimics the movement that the person intended to make. That is, you're basically reading the person's mind. And this was first done with simpler animals, with rats and then monkeys, and now it's being done with humans. And the possibility of taking a person who is quadriplegic and allowing them now to operate on their environment simply by reading their thoughts is to me, stunning. Mm-hmm. It's simply stunning.
In preparing for this show, looking at some neuroscience in recent news, it sounds like let me just read you this what is described in the article that I have in front of me, the first non-invasive person-to-person brain interface, using electrical brain recordings and a type of magnetic stimulation. A University of Washington researcher was reportedly able to transmit a brain signal through the internet and control the hand motions of a colleague. Is that somewhat related to what you're talking about?
somewhat. I think if I remember, I remember reading about this. This is quite recent.
Yes.
And it wasn't exactly, I might be mistaken here, you can correct me. It was my impression that the brainwave from one person over the net then triggered a device which actually made the movement. It didn't actually tell the device exactly how to make the movement.
Mm-hmm.
It just triggered the device. And it's cool stuff. I don't know what else to say about it.
it is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, a lot of the things they're doing today are extraordinarily exciting and offer enormous potential. But the word is potential.
Right.
And that's the key word. You know?
John Brugge, we haven't gotten to you yet as far as what, when you look back over the past generation or so, what you see as a momentous leap forward in neuroscience.
Let me go back to what George Pollack was alluding to, and that is the use of computers, both in driving a prosthetic device and using the internet, for example, as a way of transmitting brainwaves. You have to think back, because technology often drives research, where research follows technology, that in 1960, we hardly knew what a small digital computer was. There were very large computers. And before the use of computers in a neuroscience laboratory, neuroscience wasn't even a term used in those days, but a neurophysiology laboratory, everything was done rather crudely by hand or by film, and maybe hand calculators. And then along came a digital computer that could be in the hands of a laboratory scientist. And this was around 1960. It was revolutionary, truly revolutionary. And from then, it advanced, and we've followed it over the years. So now we take for granted that every lab is going to have. You walk in labs now, and scientists are not sitting around tinkering with dials and wires and stuff. They're sitting at computer terminals. And not only that, but it's extraordinarily more powerful, and it can do things, as George Pollack was describing, and many others. And in fact, if you now have been following the neuroscience developments, there are major initiatives which are coming down the pike, just announced by Barack Obama in his State of the Union and in the White House in April, of a major brain initiative, which is to develop new tools for studying the brain, with the idea that we need new tools. If we're going to understand how the human brain works, we're going to have to bring together technologies that haven't been brought together yet from fields like computer science, mm-hmm. engineering, genetics, molecular biology, physiology.
I'm glad you brought that up, John, because we reported on this, the Brain Initiative. The National Institutes of Health, as a matter of fact, just released a long report on the future of neuroscience. It's, I think, one of the first steps in President Obama's Brain Initiative. Why did we need the president to declare a brain initiative? Were we off track, or did we need to pull various groups together? I mean, we were doing brain science before this initiative. How does this brain initiative change the quality of what we're doing going forward?
Well, we don't know. We'll find out 10 years from now if it was a good idea. But think about how scientists work, right? Sort of the analogy is one of an oil field. Right? You've got a bunch of oil derricks sitting side by side, and they're burrowing deep into the ground. But there are not many lateral connections. And science works that way. Individuals sitting in their labs doing their thing.
You're all siloed, so to speak.
Yeah.
In silos. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. There's the Iowa analogy going across the Iowa countryside. And so that's how we work, little cottage industries, but digging deeply, deeply, deeply. And not communicating all that well. So this is an attempt to do that, is to bring together people who are developing all of these technologies and focus them on how they can bring to bear on some of the really serious problems we have in the field of neurological health. When you think about it, there are about 600 neurological diseases. So this initiative is being driven not only by the need to understand better the human brain, it's being driven by the costs of what's coming down for medical care. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the cost, for example, of dementias in this country, well, the cost for this country in treating dementia is it's over $100 billion a year. The Brain Initiative over 10 years is going to be $3 billion.
Very small.
$3 billion. Yeah. That's right. It's peanuts. You wonder how they can do it.
And this Brain Initiative, by investing this relatively small sum of money, what hope do you all have for tackling dementia, being able to stave off dementia, or even perhaps reverse it? I don't know. Brett Schofield.
Oh, I think one of John's talked about everybody working in their silos, and I think that's quite true. It reflects in part the fact that while there's been explosion of technology available to us, the experiments that we're doing these days are still very difficult and often take several years to accomplish. So there's a lot of inertia involved in a research program. So while we make advances in some areas, we also realize that there are aspects of our research that are being unattended to. And this initiative is talking about that need for increased communication and collaboration between groups that haven't been working together so much. So it takes an initiative like this to promote the risk-taking, really, that's involved in establishing those collaborations and overcoming the inertia of just digging deeper in our own little region.
So much to talk about in the area of neuroscience. Unfortunately, we have less than 10 minutes left. If you just joined us, three prominent neuroscientists with us on River to River. They're visiting Iowa. Just listening to Brett Schofield of Northeast Ohio Medical University, a professor of anatomy and neurobiology, George Pollack, and John Brugge with us. John Brugge from University of Wisconsin and Madison, and George Pollack from the University of Texas. Let me sort of shift a little bit in the few remaining moments that we have to talk about what I'm interested in. You're so knowledgeable about neuroscience and about your own specific fields within neuroscience, but most of us have very little knowledge of neuroscience, and I'm sure you run across that in discussions you have with neighbors or friends and things like that. But it seems that we get a lot of our understanding, most of it, our understanding comes from pop culture. I wanted to bounce at least a couple movies that are neuroscience related off of you. I don't know if you like to go to these sort of movies, but I'll pick one of the most popular ones on my list to see how that lines up with neuroscience. Here it is, Avatar, we had from a couple years ago. Did you all see Avatar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, didn't see. Brett, you didn't see it, but two of the three, you did see it. So this is where our hero, I guess, he plugs in sort of a neuro ponytail into the brain of his avatar, and then he lays down in a sort of a coffin-like thing, and he's able to control an avatar. Could our brains at one time in the future be connected with another, control something physically moving in a space somewhere else on the planet or in another part of the universe or the solar system? John Brugge, it looks like you might have an answer.
No.
Or are we so far out there nobody wants to tackle?
It makes a great movie. It makes a great movie. I'll have to go see it for sure.
Okay. Okay. Any thoughts on that, George Pollack?
Well, the movie was fun to watch. I really enjoyed it. But, I mean, it's so far out beyond the realm of
okay.
reality that it's difficult to comment on. But you just made a statement. Would it be possible in the future to take someone's brain waves, if you will, and transport them over the internet, as John just said, and perhaps control something else? And the answer to that is absolutely. And in fact, it's already been done. I mean, one of the not in the way that Avatar did it, but basically, as I was mentioning before, some scientists at Duke actually were recording from a monkey that is from the motor cortex of a monkey, part of the cortex that controls movement, having the computer interpret that movement, sending it over the internet, and then actually moving a robotic device at MIT the way in which the monkey intended to make the movement. And it's things of that sort will, I think, be possible. Now, how they'll be used, I don't know, but yeah, they'll be possible. They already are in a way.
Okay, so not completely off base there. Here's another quite a bit older movie. Maybe you saw this. It wasn't quite as big as Avatar. It happened to be Natalie Wood's final film from 1983. It's called Brainstorm. And it's you talked, George Pollack, about recording things from the brain. This is a research team science fiction film, obviously. They perfect a system that directly records all the sensory and emotional feelings of a subject with a helmet, okay? And so they record these, and so, for instance, one of the subjects is racing through the Alps in a sports car and has all of the feelings and sensory inputs recorded, and they can be played back. Is that too fanciful, or is that at some point imaginable? Of course, we watch a movie. We have the visual side, the auditory, captured, played back for us. What about expanding to other senses and even feelings? Imaginable?
Not in my opinion.
You're shrugging, George,
I don't
over there.
Think so
it's too far out there.
It's way, 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 way far out.
Way, way out.
In my judgment, I don't know, John, what do you think?
Well, on the other hand, you certainly can capture your senses with virtual devices. If you've ever listened over earphones to virtual sounds, or put a helmet on and watched virtual scenes, add to that odors and tastes and touch, puts you in a different environment. It puts you in another world, and that world can be any world you choose it to be. Now, whether or not you can inject emotions, moods, feelings, that's another story. But certainly anything that can be captured by the senses can put you in that world.
Okay. Let me ask you this before we have to close this hour. Let's imagine I am an all-knowing genie, okay? And you get to ask me one single question, only one single question about the brain, about neuroscience. You can go as big as you'd like with this question. It doesn't have to be specifically your field. What question would it be and why? You get that one wish granted if I am a real genie. John?
Yeah. So, Ben, I'd like to know the answer to whether or not there is a mind, and is it separate from the brain?
A mind? So you're talking about what, consciousness?
Well, I'm talking about a dualistic relationship.
Mm-hmm. Explain what you mean.
Does everything that we that reaches consciousness, is that all simply the physics and chemistry of neurons in our brain operating in various dances? Or, in fact, is it something more ephemeral than that? It's the old Descartes dualism of mind-body. Where do you stand on that? What's the answer to it?
Okay. I'll think about that for a moment. Let's get another question here. Brett, do you have a question that you'd like answered?
Well, I'd actually have to say I'd have to go straight to the issue of consciousness and
consciousness.
The relationship between brain activity and consciousness. It's very close to what John just brought up, but it would be the one that I'd want to go after.
Okay. The nature of consciousness for you too, George Pollack, or something completely different?
I would agree with both of them.
So we're at a consensus of the question you'd like the genie to answer.
Well, I'll tell you, in that metaphysical sense, if you will, one of the things that I've always wondered about is how is it possible that the firing of a few neurons in a certain part of your brain can give you feelings that are absolutely beyond description, just aesthetic. Or, at the other hand, they can make it pure hell, such as you can imagine if a dentist drills through your tooth and hits a nerve.
Yeah.
On the other hand, other feelings are just so joyful. How is that possible?
Okay.
Because there's no external energy associated with these kinds of things. It's all internal. How is that? It relates to the same questions that they're asking also.
We'll have to leave our listeners and this room with those questions in mind, because we've come to the end of our hour. Thank you, George Pollack, Brett Schofield, and John Brugge. It's been a fascinating hour. We could continue it many hours and never cease to explore many fascinating areas in your field of science. And you are all here. We want to remind you to they've been invited to Iowa State University to speak as part of Neuroscience Day. That's coming up Friday, September 20th. John, George, and Brett, I want to thank you very much for joining me this hour.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, man. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Helping Ames for us by Jason Burns. Thank you, Jason. Executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Join us tomorrow for another News Buzz edition of River to River. Hope to talk to you then.